You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode Altitude. Number 2.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protect through.
Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect
through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect
through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through. Fire
protect through. Fire protect through. Fire protect through.
Well, there's always like the right of self-defense, and so that was the first time you're like, well, man, like I'm seeing fire from this thing. I know they just got shot, and I'm trying to coordinate, but then you kind of lose track of where guys are as they start moving into this complex. You're like, I know the bad guy's there, but dude, I don't know if there's two army guys that are now like trying to go attack him.
That's the voice of Major Matt Fittitucker, the guest for today's podcast. He's currently an F-35 pilot, although he's also flown the F-16 as well as the T-38. He's going to tell us a little bit about his journey in aviation as well as some of the things he's done in the Air Force. But before we get started today, a few admin items. A lot of the feedback I got from the last episode was, I got to wait 2 weeks for the next episode. And while I hope to be able to change this in the future, right now, I'm just not able to increase the frequency based on what I have going on in my life. However, I did create a Patreon page, which is allowing me to bring you more content in between episodes. That's patreon.com/theafterburnpodcast. And if you have a tough time spelling Patreon like me, it's patreon.com. And you might be asking, Rain, what does this get me? Well, I'll give you some examples. At the patch level, you're going to get unedited episodes right when I record them. They'll be uploaded. Sitting there right now is an interview with Steve Reichert, who is credited with a kill of over 1,600 meters in Iraq. He's also a survivor of an IED attack, as well as an interview with Major Cody Shiv Wilton, the A-10 demo pilot. Also question and answer sessions up there, behind the scenes photos, videos. And then at the next level of director ops, you're going to see who's coming on the show and be able to participate and formulate questions for me to ask upcoming guests, as well as a few other benefits there. Again, swing over to patreon.com if you're interested in some additional content and supporting the show. I'd also like to thank again Matt Jolly over at warbirdradio.com, where this podcast is hosted, and then Jello over the Fighter Pilot Podcast. Both those individuals have been a huge help for me, and I encourage you to go over and check out their content. And last but not least, I'd like to thank the sponsor for this episode, Wingman Watch. Go over to wingmanwatch.com and you can start building your group's custom watch today. It's a veteran-owned company, and everything is built right here in the good old US of A with Swiss movements and at a fraction of the price you would pay for some other watches out there. I love my watches. Highly encourage you to swing over to wingmanwatch.com. If you find something you like that's already on there, you can use the code RAIN10. That's RAIN10 and receive 10% off your order. Well, I think that's enough of the admin stuff and time to get after the podcast. I got my good buddy, Matt Fitty Tucker, sitting here. F-35 pilot. He's flown the F-16. He's flown the T-38. He's done a lot of stuff in the Air Force, and it's going to be exciting to hear about his journey. So with that being said, Matt, or Fitty, let's get rolling. I already mentioned a little bit about what you've flown so far, but can you tell us where your Air Force journey started and what that looked like?
So I went to school, University of Florida, did ROTC there. I basically went to college not sure what I was going to do. I wasn't really convinced that Air Force was the way, and then decided I was not ready to sit behind a desk and do a different job. So I gave ROTC a shot. From there, I got a pilot training slot and I went to Vance Air Force Base, so old Enid, Oklahoma. Went to pilot training. My first assignment, like you, was a FAPE, so first assignment instructor pilot. So I got the opportunity to save my life on a daily basis. from there, went to go fly F-16s in Fort Worth, Texas. So it was a cool opportunity where they call it the TFI, the Total Force Integration. So there's like me plus about 8 other active duty guys that are plugged into reserve unit. So we were on a Navy base in the middle of Texas, which is all sorts of messed up. So an Air Force unit on a Navy base in the middle of Texas, where they would still say welcome aboard every time you drove through the gate. Just trying to figure out where the ship was in Fort Worth, Texas. With them, we deployed to Afghanistan. A little bit different than probably your experience deployment. So out of a 6-month deployment, we rainbowed, they call it, with the Homestead unit from Miami, Florida. So really, we were only responsible for about 3 months of that deployment, which is pretty sweet. And then of the active duty guys did 3 months, the reservists only did about 6 weeks. So it was kind of like a hardship TDY. I went to go fly F-35s after that. So I was pretty convinced that Korea was the path. We'd already kind of picked out houses and figured out how Mandy and the kids were going to, do a year without me. But totally lucked out and landed the F-35 assignment down in Florida. So we're a schoolhouse down there. Teaching mostly, they call them TX students, so the transition students. So guys like you and I that previously flew a different fighter and then went to go fly F-35s. We just started recently with our initial B course. So we're the first class going through now, but it's mostly these TX guys. So experienced fighter pilots that go to fly Hill or now Eielson. We've done a good job, I think, as a community to kind of break the mold and kind of develop our own like F-35 culture, if you will.
And I've heard like the 35 community has done a pretty good job of, guys are like, they won't tie on to like, well, in the A-10 we did this, or in the Viper we did this. They've embraced it. So I know that hats off, like that's got to be a challenge in itself just to kind of break that mold and figure out how do you fight with this plane.
Yeah, it is. And I think we probably learned a lot from the Raptor community. And we kind of knew that, I think, as it started. And you could see it, there's early on, there was, the Strike Eagle community, there's the Viper community. And we have a lot of Viper dudes that kind of, I think, early on. But yeah, I think generally everyone usually gets ridiculed when you say something like, well, in the Viper, we did this, or, everyone's like, oh, really? Are you a Viper pilot? Or are you a F-35 pilot? So, yeah, I think for the most part, we've done pretty good. And I think that the next challenge there was, and we can talk more in detail, but the way the F-35 was brought up, so that the operational test was running concurrently with developmental tests. So as opposed to like previous platforms where they would develop a jet entirely and then kick it to the operational test guys to build tactics on it, we were kind of doing things at the same time. So what that led to is there was almost like a way Eglin did it, a way Hill did it, a way Luke was doing it. And so we kind of had these different islands, which we've got past now. I think part of that was we didn't have a full up weapon school that was stood up yet. They're still kind of figuring that out as well. So once we established the weapon school where all the tactics kind of fall from, it got everyone as best we could, I think, on the same page. And we're starting to see the blend. So the blend of the culture, the backgrounds, as well as the blending of different bases on kind of like everyone had their own islands of how they did stuff.
Which is a good point, because the F-35 got a lot of bad press in the beginning. It still gets some bad press because people want to compare it to the A-10 and doing close air support. And obviously that is not the mission of the F-35. It can do it, but
yeah, absolutely.
We need to go kick down the door in some bad places. But do you think the fact that those two ran concurrently, the operational test as well as the developmental test, is that why it got bad press, or what factors went into that?
I think so. I think, and part of it too, is the fact that this plane grew up in like the social media era, you know, where everything was published on a daily basis. There's everyone had their own, whether it was like Aviation News Weekly or everyone had their own kind of like spin on trying to get the latest and greatest on what the F-35 was. And whether you're talking to a developmental test pilot, which was still the F-35 stuff, or you're talking to the operational dudes, you got two totally different stories on where the plane was. You know, like there's the story came out for a while about how, you know, a 2-bag Viper with tanks on it, you know, whooped an F-35, when really the background behind the story, like, was they were developing the flight controls, and like that F-35 was not full up, we'll call it, you know, it wasn't totally unlocked with all the flight control logic. So they're still running a test on it. Like, of course, like the jet wasn't ready, and it wasn't the goal of that flight wasn't to show off how well the F-35 could do it. They were developing the flight control tests and, you know, and going through that. So it's been a lot of weird early on, a lot of press, especially when you go TDYs or go different places, like everyone wants to ask questions like, you know, why does this thing suck? Why doesn't it do what it says it can do? Like, well, it depends where your source is coming from. Like, have you talked to an F-35 pilot? Have you talked to the guys that are doing it? Or are you just reading what some Joe Schmo's opinion of, you know, what it is? So,
you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the Raptor, when we got the F-22, we got the F-16, this is a fully operational, capable plane. And different F-35 is, hey, once it's flyable and like we can land the thing, give it to us so we can start figuring out how to best employ it. That's kind of the logic went behind it, right? And then now we're getting different evolutions and blocks throughout. And it's just been really in the past like 2 years, right, that it's fully operational capable, and we don't have all our planes that are that way, right?
Yeah, you bet. So like down at Eglin, we're a schoolhouse at Eglin. The software we're running, we only have a handful of jets that are, I'll call it like the operational tape, you know, that software that can go. It's a mix of software and hardware upgrades. But Hill right now is the only one that's running, and then a couple guard units. So Vermont just got theirs. And as more squadrons are standing up, Allison up in Alaska is going to get them, they're starting the stand-up process. But those are only guys with the operational software on the plane. So we've had it for a long time, and there's a strong push to get it to this like initial operating capability, and then call it like it was good enough to go do stuff, but it wasn't like the end result. And if you think about it, so the plane, although it looks like a plane, right? It has two wings, got an engine, it's got wheels. Like it is a flying computer. It's the software on the thing is ridiculous, and that's what makes it what it is. So if you think about Apple or Microsoft, or like when you got your first iPhone, like iPhone 1 is not like it was, you know, the iPhone 11, like a drastic light year difference. So it's the way you release software is like you have the idea of what it's going to get to, and then you have to start somewhere. And like, here's block one, here's block two, here's block three. And you got to keep increasing it. And so the end state is that it's an incredible jet. It can do some pretty crazy things. It obviously wasn't there when all the politics. And then of course, once you involve politics and money and how things go on, it just gets a weird twist to it.
That was one thing I had people on the air show circuit would always ask, and everyone's like, why does F-35 suck? Why is it terrible? I'm like, it's not. And I had limited experience flying anything tactical with F-35, but I did a couple exercises. And I was like, I can attest that when we have the F-35 there, like the F-16 is incredibly, it's much more lethal just because of the data and things like that, that the F-35 is sharing with the fight. It's an impressive plane, and it really has just been an uphill battle because everyone's like, ah, it's terrible at close air support. It'll never replace the A-10. It's like, that's not what it's designed for.
Yeah. I think part of that too, like early on, that was the idea. I was like, well, what's going to replace? And there was something that came out a while ago about like, yeah, it's going to take over for the A-10. A-10 has been unfortunately on the chopping block for like, you know, as long as I've been in the Air Force. You always hear like, it's going away. Okay. We need it. So I don't know if it was like a politics game or where that leaked, but I mean, yes, we do train to cast sort of, you know, but that's not what we're built to do. That idea is that you're using the stealth capabilities and all the sensor fusion and the integration to kick down the door of Iran, you know, Russia, China, like those type of fights. It's not, although you probably will see in Afghanistan doing stuff. That's not the bread and butter of what we train to.
Yeah. Contested environments. So environments that are not permissible. You're going to have people shooting stuff that's really advanced from the ground that you need to be able to sneak in there and do stuff. So yeah, interesting to hear your perspective on that and kind of like the background, because I don't think a lot of people know that. And it's an info war and people are always fighting it. It seems like the people who scream about the A-10 are always the loudest. So what was it like going from the F-16 to the F-35?
And it was different. It's the F-16 is my first love. You know, I love flying that plane.
And it's the best fighter out there. But yeah.
It's good looking. it's hard to even explain. So the flying is, although we're getting flight control logic that I feel like is similar to what the F-16 was. But man, the F-16, like you sit in there and it feels like you strap the jet onto you, like on your back, right? The F-35 is a little bit bigger feel. The cockpit's a little bit bigger. I think that's part of it too. You don't have the bubble canopy. There's a lot of frustrations early on because of what I was used to seeing in the Viper, as far as, you know, I had total visibility all around. You're somewhat limited per se. There's workarounds and things you can do, but so initial, just like getting in the plane flying, you kind of early on, it was a little frustrating on trying to figure out how to get the same viewpoints that I had before in the Viper. But man, the flying is incredible. The fact that, you know, like the Raptor, like the post stall flying. So you can totally control the nose in a full up stall. Like, you know, as you can pull back on the stick, you can command up to 50 degrees alpha or AOA.
Yeah.
35 degrees is the critical angle attack. So I can command another 15 degrees on top of that. So I get this nose track, which is eye opening if you haven't seen it when you fight against someone else. So you know, even if you start as like a, I'll call it counter offensive, so a defensive looking position, the ability to get the nose turning around to threaten the dude that's behind you, is pretty incredible. Like the thing flies pretty well, and it's got a ton of power. Once you're down low, I mean, the thing just cooks, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I feel like it kind of acts like a clean Viper day when you're just raging at 400 knots and just sustaining 9 Gs. We're not quite there. But once you get below 10,000 feet, like this thing cooks pretty good. That's the flying aspect. Like, so I really enjoy flying the F-35. I think I probably enjoyed just like the pure basic of flying the Viper probably better. I mean, it's like kicking out like the, you know, 60 Chevy in your garage. You just crank the thing up. It just works. But man, as far as the amount of information that the F-35 gives you is unbelievable. Like, you go to these large force exercises where there's 80 jets flying around. And in the Viper, man, you would think skinny, right? You had your four ship, you would kind of go, man, I see a lot of stuff on the radar and I don't really know who's who, you know, as you're trying to figure it out. And in the F-35, I mean, you just show up and it, like, the jet just knows. It just IDs things. It tells you where the good guys are. It tells you where the bad guys are. You know, when we fly formation in the F-16, we're a mile to a mile and a half apart, you know, right? So you're 3 to 4 miles from like the two outriggers as a four ship.
Yeah.
In the F-35, we're, you know, 60 to 80 miles apart. Like, you don't see your wingman, but you have all the information from his jet. You look out in the helmet, you can see where he's at. So you have instant SA on what's going on around you. So that was probably the biggest eye opener early on to me. It was just the amount of information that this jet just gives you is nice. It also really sucks when you lose that information, because like in the F-16, I remember like you would build your SA, right? You had these bullseye maps, you know, that would show you like the layout of the airspace, and you knew where the terrain was, you knew where your targets were. And you had all these pictures of stuff. Well, in the F-35, all that stuff's sort of, I'll call it sort of done for you by the plane. So you don't have to spend as much brain bites building this mental picture of where things are. So when that stuff goes out, you know, every once in a while we have, you know, display issue, whatever, like it's an instant SA dump. And you go from like King Kong of the world, knowing everything, to like, dude, you were lost in the world.
Yeah. You're just a supersonic Piper Cub.
Exactly. And you're by yourself, right? You're 80 miles away from your wingman. So you're like, oh, this is not good.
Yeah, out there alone and afraid, not exactly where we want to be. Well, to shift gears here just a little bit, you did a deployment to Afghanistan, the F-16. Can you tell me a little bit about that and your experience there?
It was good. Like I said, again, it was like kind of a hardship TDY. It was only 3 months long. We were in Bagram, so kind of like the northeastern portion of Afghanistan.
Yeah, and for those who aren't familiar with Bagram, I mean, it's surrounded by mountains. So the environment is completely different than you and anywhere you've ever flown before. And now you're going out there doing the mission, loaded the plane out with weapons, lives are on the line. It is a different environment when you step out the door to go to war.
No, yeah, it's definitely different. It's like you said, when you start putting real weapons on the plane. And I think the weird part too is, and I say weird, the interesting part was the fact that we were basically doing support of like task force guys, so like the special ops army guys. And they were on base with us. Well, they were basically across the runway. So we would develop a personal relationship with these guys. You'd meet the guy that you're about to go on a mission with and talk to him on the radio. And so it adds a little bit more, I guess, realness to it, when, as opposed to just being a voice on the other end of the radio, like, you knew that was Mike that you met at the chow hall. You know, when you're eating dinner with him, like, you know, making jokes and being funny, and then you hear him on the radio and you can hear the stress in his voice or whatever. So it just adds, you know, a little bit more realness to what you're doing.
Yeah, it's a whole other dynamic. I mean, there's a face with a voice, and you just brief with them, or you ate dinner with them. So did you guys like usually brief with them, or just like a telephone call? I know, 'cause there's some logistics to getting over to the other side there.
Yep. If there was, a higher emphasis, like, mission they're doing, sometimes we'd be able to brief like the day prior, or kind of get read into some of the stuff they're doing. Most, it's like 90% of the time, it's just you were given products. Sometimes you do a brief like phone chat with them, or sometimes it was just you meet them out on the radio. You know, you just knew, you start to knew, you could pick up call signs on who people were, and usually based on the call sign, you kind of had the idea of what the mission was going to be, whether it was just armed overwatch, where you're basically just flying overhead, making some noise, or just, you know, kind of on call, or whether or not it was like a deliberate strike where you're going out to do something. Like, you kind of took off with already knowing what your objective was and what your targets were.
At that point, were you guys doing a lot of HVI, high value target, or high value individual, like surgical type strikes, or was it mostly armed overwatch, or was this a smattering of different mission sets?
Yeah. So I'd say it was definitely a mix. I'd say a lot of what I flew was this armed overwatch, or you're just basically airborne alert. Just, you're kind of holding, burning circles in the sky, waiting for something to happen. And then you'd be the quick response time while they sorted out, you know, the rest of the firepower. So it was a mix. It was a mix of just launching and being ready, or going out with guys that were either like clearing there. I mean, we even joked about, like, there, we even had a mission once where the food facility that was next to Bagram, a lot of stuff was flown in, but a lot of stuff was trucked in. And so they had an issue where they're having a bunch of riots in this food packaging facility, which was limiting what food we were getting at Bagram. Like, it really cut back to what they could get in there. So in the meantime, they basically started these, it was almost like a riot control team. You know, they would go out with like all their Humvees and they would basically roll through this thing to just show presence, to kind of, because once we showed up, whether it was dudes on the ground or just making noise, like, everything would kind of break up and go away. But, you know, the locals couldn't control it when, you know, these people started rioting in the streets, which affected our ice cream and our eggs for breakfast. So, I mean, we had a couple of times where we did armed overwatch for these guys that were just going to run patrols through this food packaging facility, or basically, I don't know, like a complex where they would just truck stuff in. So we would do that. We'd make some noise over that. It would scatter the riots, and then they would fill the food trucks up and bring it back to Bagram. So it went from, like, no kidding, targeting where we're going out, knowing we were going after, like you said, like a high value individual or someone they've been watching for a long time, all the way down to just, you know, making noise over top of trucks to keep those dudes safe as they did their patrols.
What was the feeling going from hanging out, burning holes in the sky, to getting called in? Shifting gears, it's usually like 90% of it's all like boring, benign stuff, and the like 10% of the flying is like adrenaline through the roof.
Yeah, especially when you had, we'd have, they call them vols, like vulnerability periods, where you have to fly for, you know, 6 to 8 hours. So you're like on hours, you know, 4 or 5 or 6, and you've hit the tanker, you know, 15 times. You're just trying to stay awake. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, I was on the night shift there, which was good and bad. It was nice because it was not hot during the day, but it was also kind of suck because it was always dark, you know, when you flew. So, you know, you're trying to do stuff to keep yourself awake. You're going to the tanker a lot. You're talking to your wingman. You're, you know, just kind of touring around Afghanistan. And then out of nowhere, all of a sudden, you know, something would pop up and you have to go, like you said, like 0 to 100 in about 10 seconds. And so a challenge, I think for most guys too, is to go from like, how do you mentally deal with that? Like, how do you go from just like, you're like, how do I stay awake doing fun, you know, funny jokes or tricks, to holy smokes, guys are getting shot at. Like, how do I get back to this, you know, being this professional aviator and break. And like you said, not get spun up, especially when you're talking to a guy on the ground, you can hear his voice that he's panicked or he's amped up too. You can hear gunshots in the background. And then you have to find a way to be that voice of reason in the air and kind of slow things down. Those guys are pretty good at what they do in the ground, but sometimes they're getting shot at and they don't know where from, and they're calling for airstrikes and they want you to freaking blow everything up. And, you know, if you step back from it and go, that's probably not the smartest thing. We probably need to, you know, how do I support him, but not also, you know, just demolish a bunch of civilians and, you know, the stuff in the process. So it was interesting, like, kind of mental gymnastics on how you go from, like, being tired, being, you know, just quiet night to all of a sudden, like, holy smokes, we're in the middle of a firefight. How do I objectively, like, calm this guy down, give him the firepower he wants, and not, you know, do stuff that we shouldn't be doing?
Even just getting to where you need to go, like, that's a challenge in itself, right?
Yeah. You mean, like, around the country?
Or? Yeah, around the country, and, like, finding out, once you get a retasking, like, who are you talking to? How are you getting there?
Yeah.
Who else is there? I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, right?
Yep. Cause I mean, and that we saw, like, we would also sit alert on the ground. So depending on what was going on that night, you could be like on a 15-minute alert or 30-minute alert or an hour alert. And that was just basically your response time from when you get the call to when you should be airborne. So if you're on like an hour alert, was kind of more chill. You could not be dressed and ready to go, because an hour is kind of the normal pace to go take off. But once you get into like the 30 minutes or 15 minute alert, you know, you're dressed, ready to go. They literally, we had a cowbell in the squadron. So you get a phone call and like the guy sitting at the desk would start ringing the cowbell. And that was your signal to, you know, and it was literally, you'd run to the jets, you'd get it started as fast as you could. And, you know, you'd have to, I mean, it was simple stuff. Like, you had to make sure you're strapped in before you took off. Like, you'd be doing, you're so amped up that you'd forget to do stupid stuff. And then you have to fly across the country, you know, with the speed of heat, find the tanker somewhere. And then, like you said, go through all like the, who am I talking to? And you can't just go rage into the middle of this fight. You know, there's usually guys in the stack above you, whether there's Predator or UAVs or helicopters down low. And so you had to like really pause for a minute and go, okay, like, you know, the whole, you know, cliche, like, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Like, you have to slow things down, because otherwise you're just going to totally, you know, hurt someone or yourself. So like you said, like trying to figure out, I mean, what radio frequency do I get on, which is a huge demand. You can be watching the fight and not know where he's talking to, and whether it's secure radios or if you're on SATCOM or, you know, all that stuff. And then try to figure out who's above you, who's below you. And then trying to figure out like who are the bad guys and who are the good guys, you know, like there's just nothing but tracer bullets going back and forth. And you're trying to figure out, you know, and just doing, I mean, you play the telephone game, or when you're a kid, you know, you pass, he says, she said, whatever. So there's a guy on the ground that might be talking to a guy, you know, on SATCOM who's talking to, you know, the MT-12 guy, who then relays the message to me. And so now I have to go back and confirm to make sure that you don't get led down a path where, like, you know, especially when you're showing up and you're all amped up and you're ready to help dudes out. Well, if you start making yourself believe what you think you want to believe based on the words you're hearing, you know, you can obviously make a mistake pretty quick and drop munitions on the wrong people. So that was a hard part, to be like so amped up and then try to slow things down and then figure out, you know, just get the whole mental picture and try to build what's going on.
Yeah. So how do you think you get to the point where you're able to go from basically idle, even though you're cruising around 300 knots, to running a million miles an hour, thrown into a firefight, able to orient and figure out what needs to be done and how you can affect the fight? Because it's not just combat where that's applicable. I think that skill set at its core is applicable to most people, being able to orient into a situation that's dynamic and challenging.
Yeah, I mean, the training aspect is huge. I think in general, we do a pretty good job of, when we get spun up for deployments, like doing exactly, you know, just a repetition of the same stuff over and over again. And then at least for us, especially in Fort Worth, we had a lot of really experienced dudes. Most of them are reservists that have been doing this for 20 years. So I really, hung, I guess, my tactics and my skills on stories I heard from the guys that went before me, or even guys that were there with us that had done it before. So you really, you know, kind of lean on those guys and you listen to their pacing and how they do stuff. Like, you know, when we showed up, you know, we did a lot of training, but then I show up day one to Afghanistan. I'm like, here, like my first deployment, that was my first time out of the US, you know, besides going to the Bahamas as a kid.
Yeah.
So it's a lot going on. And so like you're all amped up and you're ready to go. And then you start, I think a lot, one of the biggest lessons is like, you know, never miss an opportunity to shut your mouth, you know? And so you kind of show up there and you have to know, like, yes, I want to be at the top of my game and I have to believe in my mind that, you know, I'm the best pilot in the world, you know, doing what I'm doing. But you have to know that you have to be ready to absorb and listen to people who have gone before you and, you know, done it before, and just kind of watch their flow and watch how things go. And you spend a little bit of time observing, and then you kind of slowly start feeding your own techniques in there. And then eventually, you know, you're pretty confident in what you're doing. But I think that's probably translatable to any job you go to. If you kick in the door day one thinking you know everything, like you're probably setting yourself up for, you know, fall on your face. They always joke, they say that it's better for you, you know, for them to think you're an idiot and keep your mouth shut versus you open your mouth and prove them right. You know,
like, so I love that.
I subscribe to that wholeheartedly. So I, you know, my mantra, I think, is like the first 6 months anywhere I go, I'm always just kind of quietly sit, observe, figure it out. And you learn a lot more by keeping your mouth shut. And I mean, same thing, you still do what you're going to do. And you still, you know, fly your jet and do all that stuff, but just by showing up there. And from that type of lesson I learned, like watching some guys I wholeheartedly respect, and I was flying as their wingman. And, you know, here I am thinking like, man, we're going to go drop bombs, we're going to do this, and I'm ready to go. And, you know, this guy is like slowly going stuff. I'm like, what, like, how is he not ready? Like, I know where people are. I know stuff. And, you know, and I remember that I think it was the first time it was the first or second time we dropped bombs over there. Obviously, you know, that's my first time dropping bombs in Haight. And we check in and, man, I'm ready to go. And I think I have the whole thing doped out. Like, I've done this 100 times in training. I have the picture figured out. And the guy I'm flying with is, again, super experienced. And I'm starting to like almost not question what he's doing, but I'm like, man, he must be off his game. Like he doesn't have the SA based on what I'm hearing on the radio of what I think I have. But because I've shot myself in the foot before, I kind of keep my mouth shut for a minute, and we do a couple more laps around the circle as we sort things out. And the way the guy on the ground was describing the target to us, I was locked onto a whole different area. And so like and it was one of those things, like I was led down a path where like the way he was saying things, I saw something outside versus like, you know, they teach you to like kind of build the picture in your mind and then use confirming comm. So like, I go, okay, you talked about this four-way intersection. And then I'll say, okay, I see the four-way intersection. And on the northeast corner, I see this building that looks like the letter H. And they go, yep, there's, you know, and if you look at that building, look just north, they kind of keep adding more comm to it. Well, I was going down the path of just listening to what he said. I look outside and I see something that looks similar to it. And I kind of almost talk myself into it. And then we eventually have a conversation, my flight lead and I was like, hey man, I think you can throw like targets out there. I can data link stuff to him. I go, I think this is what I'm looking at. And he's like, no man, you're looking about 100 meters to the south. And then I move my target over to where he is. And sure enough, like it's a very similar looking picture. But because this guy he saw both of them, my flight lead, and he was like, man, and he went like, we need to start over again. And like had basically calmed this guy down, kind of reintroduced the talk on of like where the target was. And we ended up finding the right spot, dropped the right bombs. But dude, if I would have gone off with what I thought, and I would have bet you $1 million that I had it figured out. So I think that was kind of like my first waking up to going like, man, I need to slow things down when I show up here and not just bite off on the first thing I see just because I'm amped up, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Did the same thing. Like target talk-ons are challenging, and it's an art form, building the puzzle by not giving all the answers and making sure you're both are seeing the same thing, because that's like the worst thing in the world that could possibly do is put ordnance down in the wrong spot and kill someone who didn't need to be killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were supporting troops in contact or?
We did. We had a couple times where we would launch. And a lot of times we call it like, you know, the escalation of force. So the whole goal wasn't to drop bombs and every single person that, you know, caused issues or whatever. So a lot of times we would show up. We had a couple like early on troops in contact where they were, yes, in contact and trading bullets back and forth, but the guys talking on the radio didn't feel super threatened. I guess they weren't being overtaken from all over. They just kind of like, hey, we got to get through this way and we can't get past them because they set up a roadblock or said whatever. And so they traded some shots back and forth. The army dudes, especially the Afghan National Army, they back up a little bit. And so we'd show up. And then so, you know, step one was to make some noise. And so he would leave a wingman up high that was kind of tracking where the bad guys were, we'll call them. And then your wingman would either kind of extend out, you know, he'd run away 10 miles, would drop down low, and then just, you know, haul the mail across, you know, just even air shows like you did. You make, you know, your surprise attack where you're kind of looking, you see the jet first, and then like the noise freaking, you know, rattles your brain. So you do that a couple times, and usually that was enough to scatter them. Or you would do that and you'd drop some flares, and depending how low you go, you'd have this like flare bucket that'd be bouncing down the street, you know, just spraying white phosphorus everywhere. And then from then you would, you know, maybe shoot the gun off in the distance, you know, to show them that you're ready to employ, and then maybe drop a bomb or do something else. And then worst cases, then you would employ, you know, if it had to go that way. So most of the time we'd show up and we'd do these like shows of forces, and that was usually enough to scatter them. Usually it was a somewhat disorganized group of fighters, whether it was ISIS or just local, you know, resistance, I guess you'd call it. I guess the biggest troops in contact we had was one that lasted for, it was, so it basically started with a mission that the task force were going off, and it was there up in like the northeast corner of Afghanistan. Anyway, so it's a pretty harsh area. So a lot of terrain, a lot of mountains. The fighters there, the Taliban, whatever it is that were fighting ISIS, is that they're some hardened people, man. They're probably walking barefoot. They've been in this, like, you know, 10,000 plus altitude their whole life. You know, that's their home. That's, you know, what they're used to fighting. So there's some stuff they were doing over there. You know, on day one, they dropped a bunch of leaflets going like, hey, we're about to do some raids over here. If you're not part of ISIS, you probably should leave. And then day two, they go out and they start doing the clearing that they do. So we had some guys that were like either on call. And so I was one of the first groups that was airborne waiting. So as things start kicking off, they start kicking down doors and doing the things they're doing. Part because, you know, it was a heavily infested, I'll call it ISIS area or ISIL, similar stuff, but, they were somewhat ready for it. I mean, they had somewhat fortified gun posts. They had sort of things. So early on, we just started, the army guys started their press. They got some resistance, so they backed off, and then we kind of leveled a couple things, you know, early on. So call again, troops in contact was kind of expected. We already had pre-planned target areas that we were going to drop on. But then stuff kicks off, and then again, you start hearing like the dudes you had lunch with or dinner with, and like you heard the story about his, like, you know, what his wife's name is, you know, how many kids he has, and like you hear him on the radio and you hear him screaming. A couple guys got shot. So we started working through it. Quickly went from like, you know, we're kicking ass and moving forward, like, holy smokes, there's a couple of young dudes that just got shot, because now we're talking about medevacs and escorting the helicopters in and clearing out areas. So that was probably the most amped up I was for the deployment was that particular, like, it went on for a day or two, because we would, you know, rotate through and send more fighters out. We would go back and either reload the jets or send, you know, another crew out there. But working through hearing those guys, hearing the progression of them, you know, coming into contact, taking fire, getting shot, and then it becomes real. And it's like, again, back to like, you got to fall back to your training. You got to calm down. You got to be the voice of reason, if you will. And a lot of times there's all these ROEs, right? The rules of engagement on like what you can drop on, how you can drop on it, who has to approve it. Well, there's always like the right of self-defense. And so that was the first time we're like, well, man, like I'm seeing fire from this thing. I know they just got shot and I'm trying to coordinate, but then you kind of lose track of where guys are as they start moving into this complex. You're like, I mean, I know the bad guy's there, but dude, I don't know if there's two army guys that are now like trying to go attack him, and I don't want to drop a bomb. But yeah, I got the freaking bad dude. Well, he also took out like four good guys. So that process, and then just going through, just doing your job, right? You're showing up there, you're making noise, you're dropping bombs when they ask for it, and then you're trying to interject the most you can with the amount of SA you have. And then the challenging part was once you're out of weapons or out of, you know, you dropped, and you only carry a handful of, you know, depending on what you're carrying on the jet. But we dropped all our bombs. And then you kind of feel helpless. Like you're like, I want to stay, even though, you know, the alert crew just launched, you do a quick handoff with those guys, you know, they're fresh dudes ready to go, full of weapons. And it's kind of weird. Like the job's not done. And it was kind of a weird thing. Like, you know, you don't want to leave because you've almost built this relationship over the past hour while these guys are fighting. And now you're like, well, I'm not ready to go home yet. I still want to help, knowing that you really can't do anything. So you don't have your weapons left, and you know, you're running low on gas and you're trying to find a tanker, and you're really just more of a hindrance at this point than help. And you feel like you have like a vested interest in it. Like you were there when they started it, and you want to, it's a weird, I mean, it's just something you learn to get over. You got to get over yourself. Like the whole Afghanistan thing is, and I think part of that too, talking to this young kid who was trying to say thanks to me. And I mean, if you think of it like a customer support type relationship, like I am just a support asset, right? Yeah. Flying a multi-million dollar jet with weapons on it. And granted, I love it, but I am not the objective. Like what I was doing was not, it was what those guys were doing on the ground. And I literally, like, they were the customer and I was just there to support what he needed and what he wanted. So if you kind of go with that mindset, just remember that, you know, every mission is different. Sometimes you are the mission, but a lot of times we're not. And so I think if you have the mentality of just of knowing where you kind of fit in the grand scheme of things, it helps you kind of get through, you know, whatever internal battles you might have.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to know where you fit and how, like, everyone's a key player, and without it, the team can't get the job done. But Sometimes you're not the tip of the spear, even if you're sitting in a F-16 or F-35. Sometimes you are. It just depends.
Absolutely.
So, Fiddy, I'd like to shift gears here just for a minute. I solicited for questions on Instagram and was inundated with the responses to the point where I don't have the bandwidth again at this point to answer all the questions. But what I want to do is incorporate a lot of those questions in guest sessions. You're the first one. This is just going to be kind of a sample of what's available on Patreon, because that's really where the meat of this is going to go. But one question, just to kind of get people a flavor of what they can go find on Patreon. This is perfect for you. It's an F-35 maintainer. Daniel Brown _12. He's an airman first class and he works on the F-35. He's applied to OTS and he's looking for advice and tips in that transition. Hopefully he ends up flying an F-35. It'd be a pretty cool story. But what do you have for him?
Yeah. I could say, first of all, like in life in general, timing is everything, right? So I think now is probably the best time we've seen in a long time to want to be a pilot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And not that we're dropping standards, but just like, you know, we are in dire need, whether it's Air Force, whether it's airlines or whatever, like, you know, needing people. So now is a definitely good time. I would say the one key advice that someone told me a while ago. So a quick backstory, when I played soccer, I played my whole life playing soccer. And so my senior of high school, in a practice messing around, I fractured a lower vertebrae in my back, and had to sit out part of the season. Long story about how, I screwed some things up I shouldn't have done, but because of that, I healed. Everything was good. I went through this whole process. Like my first 2 years of college, I wore this like full back brace and it was just absolutely miserable. Like a gimp walking around. So I go to RTC, I go through all, you know, like the 2 day process where they do all the medical reviews and figure out and everything's good, except they're like, hey, what's up with this back thing? Well, it turned out that was a disqualifying, however they diagnosed it was a disqualifier. Part of that was when they took my civilian medical records and they transcribed them to my military ones, there was a bit of a transcribing error. And so the condition I had wasn't necessarily the condition they transferred over. It was similar, but it was way worse than what I actually had. So because of that, they went through all this waiver process and I got denied. Like, you cannot fly, like, you're disqualified. And it was almost to the point where, like, I was disqualified from even commissioning the Air Force. And this is like my junior year when I'm expecting to, like, you know, get my pilot slot and do all this stuff. So it was kind of crushing early on. And I got to the point where, like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, I've already like fully committed to this, that, you know, I'm not going to be a business major anymore. I want to fly. I want to do this. And the first answer came back was like, no, you can't do it. And so I was like, I was really crushed. My dad actually was the first one that was like, well, you know, what's your plan? What do you want to do? Like, well, I really want to do this. He's like, well, then keep going. You know, like, if you accept no as an answer, like, it will be that door is forever shut. You know, like you will find, I guarantee you, like, the next door you knock on, you're going to find a no again. And like, you're going to keep finding no's. And if you just keep knocking on doors until you eventually will find a yes and you'll find a path. So he was kind of my corner, and we end up going to, I had to go to my state congressman and wrote a letter, the whole deal, explaining stuff. Because at that point, I mean, there's a lot, you know, I was just a number to the Air Force. It didn't matter. So I go to the congressman and I tell him the whole story. He goes through and I end up getting a congressional waiver, which was kind of crazy. And that got me reinstated for them to at least look at it, and I end up getting a waiver. And so it took me about a year of just knocking on multiple doors, getting multiple no's, and every no you get is just motivation to, you know, keep going. And to me, it ended up being awesome because it really drove home internally, like, what I wanted. There's a lot of things in life, you know, knowing what you don't want to do is almost as important as knowing what you do want to do. And so I knew I didn't want to not be in the Air Force and fly. And so that it really drove home, like that was the path. I'm going to find someone to say yes and find a way. So fast forward that story to advice on him is like, you will hit road bumps. You are going to find challenges, whether it's getting in a commissioning, whether it's going through pilot training, whether it's passing check rides, whether it's like, you're going to hit road bumps, and the way you deal with it, I think, is what, you know, ultimately is going to get you where you want to go. So in short, I would say, don't take no for an answer. Like find your yes, find your way. Like you will hit doors.
Yeah. 100% agree. And I can't think of a better way really to wrap up the podcast than on that note. We do have a few more questions that'll be over there on Patreon for people who are looking for additional content. But you're right. Like life is going to throw you curves. You gotta deal with it. You gotta get after it. It doesn't matter what you're doing, flying an F-35, flying F-16, doctor, lawyer, firefighter, teacher, husband, wife, you're going to have to deal with stuff. And it's going to be easier for some than it will be for others. Like that goes without saying. But you do only get one life. So I think it's important to get after it. Hopefully you guys enjoy this podcast. Again, hit the subscribe button. Leave me a review there. That definitely helps me out. Lets me know to keep doing this thing, or man, maybe I should wrap it up. But if you're looking for more content, again, go check out Patreon. A lot of stuff up there. And I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Until then, don't bring a week.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.